Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Tuesday, February the 8th, 2005. It's now 40 minutes after the hour of 8 a.m. I understand Senator Guest will not be on teleconference today. We have Senator French, Senator Terrio, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. We have several items on our list to go over today. First is SJR 1, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to an appropriation limit. Have the sponsor, Senator Dyson, here this morning. Welcome, Senator Dyson. Appreciate you being here with the Judiciary Committee this morning. And I see you've brought your erstwhile assistant Lucky with you. If you put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Fred Dyson, Senator from Eagle River, and with me is my finance staff member Lucky Schultz. And thank you for hearing these, and thank you for having the wisdom to hear SJR 1 and SJR 4 same time, because they are a matched pair that probably need to go forward together. It's kind of good news, bad news, good news. The good news is that the bill that you, or the resolution you have before you today, is, I believe, a significant improvement of what we worked on last year. Bad news is that Lucky has done much of this work without me being really active in it, and the good news is that he's done a far better job than if I had have been. And but there are some profound public policy issues here that need to be discussed at some length, and it'll be a judgment call for you all in judiciary whether how much oversight you choose to put on the financial issues, you know, before it goes on to finance, and that I certainly will trust your wisdom on that. The SJR 1 is very similar to last year's SJR 3, we've had a constitutional spending cap since 1980 or 81, and it proved quite ineffective, and the escalators in it were such that, first of all, it was cumulative and wasn't based on actual appropriations or spending, and indeed the limit exceeded to almost asymptotically and would have been up to something like $6 billion GF at this point, and really was superfluous. This one makes a couple of changes. One is that instead of adding the two escalators, and the escalators are population growth and CPI, this one multiplies them. We have a graph for you that will show you that actually makes a very small difference, but our experts tell us that it is a wiser and more economically sound way to do it, but makes a surprisingly small difference. Another added factor, and I shamelessly copied this from an issue that's before the California legislature, and it limits debt service to 6% of GF funding. And I think that there'll be active discussion about that. And right now, I think our debt service approaches 10%.
Yes, sir.
And if we indeed pass this forward with the 6% in it, it would limit increasing our indebtedness and the resulting debt service. And that's a judgment call, and I think many of in the legislature are looking forward to lots more, particularly infrastructure construction projects, and whether or not we choose to limit ourselves at this very key time in our state's development is a question that deserves some very serious consideration. But California folks were very concerned that they not keep incurring future debt and debt service payments that becomes a huge component in the budget. and so on, and I think it's worthy of some discussion. We left the 6% number in as a starting point, but I am not convinced that it's the most appropriate starting point for us. And so please consider that as a draft number, in a sense, that to do it. Also, this one does a little bit more about defining what an emergency is, and there was quite a bit of discussion in last year's bill about what is an emergency and so on. And then we have an amendment for SJR1. We put it in as a draft or early in the process pre-filing this, and then realized that because we wanted to define what happened to excess revenues, and we're concerned about repaying the money that's been borrowed from the CBR, the alleged legal folks have encouraged us that leaving those provisions in the spending limit bill gets us vulnerable to a BESS type challenge of not being single purpose legislation. So if you choose to adopt Amendment 1, it strips out of SJR1 the stuff, the material having to do with the CBR deposits. And then SJR4 covers the what happens with excess money and the CBR. And it's what Lucky and others have done on this is fascinating to me, but it sets a prudent cap on the CBR at $5 billion, which experts tell us is a good number to have in the, I don't know what you want to call a slush fund, but this fund that's available to use to take care of extraordinary events and as a repository for the times when we have excess income and a source of money to fill in the troughs in the budgeting process when there's shortfalls. And every jurisdiction that we have interacted with that has an effective spending or tax cap, all of their experts have told us that having a fund that's available to take off the peaks and valleys in the revenue stream and or funding allocations is very wise, and our CBR does that. In SJR4, the way it's presently drafted and before you, it says that that excess revenues go into repaying the CBR until it gets to the $5 billion. After that, 50% of the money goes to the permanent fund principal, 25% goes to the citizens as a dividend, and 25% goes to work down the deferred maintenance list. Whether that's the wisest thing to do with the excess revenue is a hope we will have a spirited and learned discussion about that. It is what we have proposed here as a wise way of doing it. What did I misstate?
I think that's good for now.
So this is a, if, and you'll also notice that it, the graphs, do you want to distribute the graphs to these guys? As you look at the graphs in the out years, it looks to me like 2 years out, the escalators end up being a 70, 80 million category with present assumptions of what CPI and population growth will be, and you know, and there, that should get our attention as well, either here or in finance, about whether that's enough. But the language we put in here for with the amendment would be allows for not only emergencies, which are natural or man-made disasters and things, but what we've called extraordinary events, and that is as we discussed in last year's, if something like the gas pipeline goes forward, then that allows us to go forward at ramping up expenditures, you know, that will be necessary for several years before there's any revenues coming in for it, and defines the basis on which we can expend money under that category of extraordinary expenditures. If and when you like, Mr. Chairman, I will, can go through the sectional analysis with you.
Okay. But, any questions at this point from members? Seeing none? Okay. Go ahead.
All right. If you look at the bill, page 1, lines 4 and 5, all that does is repeal the existing limit and replace it with this new appropriations limit. Lines 6 through 8 defines what the base is, and this is what it's such a clear difference from the existing one limit, in that it makes the limit based upon the actual amount appropriated in the preceding fiscal year, as opposed to the cumulative escalation that was in the old limit. And it also fixes a fixed amount for the base. Before we went through a convoluted process and tried to average the earliest of the 3 years of the preceding four in order to get a non-undulating limit or a base for it, that was really confusing language. So that's been eliminated. Page 1, lines 10 and 11, the variables, the limit remains the annual percent of change in population and the annual percent change in the CPI, or Consumer Price Index. And let's see, that in order to anticipate the wild card that would be introduced into the formula if we had a huge population influx a given year, or as we had in 1979 and 80, 18-20% inflation, there's a limit here that the CPI limit can't go up more than the personal income goes up. Is that correct?
Yes.
Just to try to limit that wild card that could happen in the future. And as I mentioned earlier, this formula multiplies the two escalators instead of adding them as we did before. Line 2 through 7 on page 2, what you have before you retains last year's language, and it says no ratchet down. So the thinking there is that if we have deflation or a decrease in population for some reason, the requirement for public services still goes on, and the impact of deflation seldom impacts the cost of the state providing services for a long time. Contracts are still in place, and way out here, the tip of the tail of the dog, the changes in the cost of goods and services doesn't go down as quickly in lockstep with the change in the CPI. So we put in the no ratchet down, and that's arguable, and maybe that should be modified, but practically speaking, my guess is that we will not see the circumstances where the need for state services will decline significantly. Absolutely a policy call. The line of exemptions, page 2, lines 11 through 29, is exactly the same as last year. I thought there was a very good discussion on it, and it, by and large, takes enterprise-type state activities out from under the cap. So if the university sells more books or has more students paying tuition and so on and so forth, they're not limited. Same way if the railroad makes more money either off their real estate or their rates and contracts, they're not limited, and it doesn't force their increased revenue doesn't force a reduction in state spending in some other area. So we're trying to be very careful about, as we last year, about having the exemptions basically speak to the kind of business-like activities that really don't have any effect on GF spending, or very little. New one on page 3, line 12 through 19, requires the Commissioner of Revenue, I believe, to give us a quarterly report on where we're at in expenditures and revenues, and then the stuff on page 3, line 20 through page 4, that will be taken out of, if you accept Amendment 1, it will be taken out of this, and it has to do with when we have revenues in excess of the limit. And if you accept Amendment 1, it will put it into SGR 4. Another one that's an interesting one, page 4, line 14, is special session. We get into a situation where spending is going to exceed the cap, or there's been a significant difference in the revenue picture. It provides for a special session, and once again I picked some language out of the California proposal that says if the governor and the legislature don't resolve the issue, then both of them lose their salaries after 10 days. And I thought that had a lot of populist appeal, but I suspect it will also engender some interesting discussion. The page 5, there, lines 8 through 20, is the 6% debt service provision. Page 5, line 23 through 30, that's transition stuff that just enables us to get a smooth transition here to operating under this new and hopefully very effective spending cap. Then Amendment 1, it deletes the stuff relating to the CBR. So that's it, sir.
Questions? Otero, you got your hand up there?
Question on page 3, at the bottom, lines 29, 30, 31. Any funds expended from the budget reserve fund shall not be considered as part of the base for the purpose of determining the allowable amount allowable for appropriations of subsequent years. Not sure. I'm just trying to figure out how that works here. Why would you, if we're in a, we have a shortfall, and we have to expend money out of the budget reserve, why you would not want that to count in the next year's base? If it just brings us up to level funding, even.
Lucky Schultz, staff to Senator Dyson, through the chair. Senator Terrio, that language is going to be deleted because that has to do with the CBR language. So it will not take effect in Amendment 1 if you approve Amendment 1.
What do you do with percentage shifts in federal funding, federal versus state funding, Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera, when that hits? Is there a mechanism to account for that, or do we find a way to reduce the lower the qualifying limit, or how do you account for that?
Want to answer that?
Yes, sir. The that's one of the exemptions on page 2, line 21. We exempt funds from the cap from the federal government, so up or down, it doesn't impact the cap at all.
So if there's a reduction in federal funding and we have to pick up a larger percentage of that, it's very clear then that that would be an increase that would not have to be otherwise approved.
Yes, sir, that is correct.
Okay. Senator Terrell?
Well, I don't think so. If, as we're experiencing right now, the federal government is going to give us, you know, 30, 40, whatever the number is, $50 million less that we have to make up with GF, mm-hmm. we have to eat that.
That's what I'm trying to figure out, if that is exemption, if that exemption is in there, so that we don't have to eat that.
No, it's not my understanding of the way this works. I mean, right. We have exempted federal funds, you know, if they go up.
Coming in.
If they go up, we can spend those, because it's money.
But if they go down, we eat it?
Secretary is correct.
Okay. And so, at that point, Senator French.
Let's finish your thought, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Well, Senator Seekins has brought up one of my concerns. I have two, but one of my concerns is that we have enjoyed an enormous amount of federal largesse over the last couple of decades. You know, our Senator Stevens has done a fantastic job of helping fund needed services in the state. And the way he's defended that against attacks in Washington is to point out, quite rightly, that Alaska is behind many other states, that we lack the things that they have because we've come along later in historical development. They've had railroads and highways and roads and post offices and medical services and universities, you know, for the last 100 years, and we're just getting there. And I guess my concern is that this freezes us in place. It says this is where we are right now, this is the baseline, we can't grow much beyond that. While there may still be great needs out there, and indeed there may be a time when we get a lot less federal largesse because of federal budget constraints. And so it may not be a question you can answer, but it's a concern of mine, and so I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
And I think I'm looking at it in terms of we have this much money that's going into federal programs. Part of it's ours, part of it's theirs, and they cut back their percentage. I have to make it very clear then in this bill that if that were to happen, that we don't just add more state money to keep it at the same level. We in effect look for ways to eliminate qualifying individuals, or we can't get there. Senator Dyson?
Well, this does not, as we've said, limit the amount of money we can spend when we have federal or other sources of money coming in. It largely is general fund money. And it does not mandate that we continue the level of effort, you know, if the revenue sources did it. And does give us a significant incentive to look for out-of-the-box ways of providing for the needs of Alaskans, and Senator French is right, it could limit the amount of services because it does put a limit on what we can spend out of general fund to meet those needs. And the experience of most jurisdictions, and I have spent all of my adult life or most of it in Anchorage, where they have a tax cap that has a similar effect in that it forces government to look for alternative ways and of meeting the public needs. And,
they come to us.
Yes, sir.
You give us the money because we don't want to tax ourselves to do it. We go to the feds, say, you give us the money because we can't do it on our revenue cap.
And if I may, Arla Sturgiluski has been a delightful friend for 20 years. And I asked Arlis last spring, what were you guys thinking about when you created the permanent fund? And don't hold her to my memory what she said, but I said, were you thinking of it as a return to the people of Alaska for the expenditure of their resource, i.e. the oil, you know, and a return on their investment? Or were you thinking of it as a way to fund an endowment that would support the cost of government when the oil fields, as they always do, were in decline? And her answer to me was, we weren't that bright and principled at that time. What we were thinking of doing is a mechanism to get the money off the table, because we couldn't control ourselves and we're spending it, and she didn't say like drunken sailors on leave, but and it was a way to build a fence around it, and as Senator Halford often said, and not have one generation of Alaskans spend all the money from this once-in-a-lifetime discovery of one of North America's largest oil fields. It was a way to preserve it for the future. And I believe we are going to see oil prices in and around $30 for the foreseeable future, and probably gas at over $5, and that we are going to see significant and steady stream of revenues to the state. And this is an attempt for us to discipline ourselves to be wise and not waste this very significant revenue stream, and to have a orderly process for utilizing those revenues. My reading of American history and the debates that went around on both in the forming of the U.S. Constitution and the Statehood Act, that the Founding Fathers anticipated the frontier areas like ours would be a long time having enough of a tax base to be able to support their own need for infrastructure and services, and they anticipated that the frontier areas would trade natural resources for both infrastructure and services for a very significant period of time. And that in the debate on the Statehood Act, there was very clear debate that the U.S. senators were afraid that Alaska could not support itself, and would be a great drain on the federal coffers for a significant period of time. They were right. But indeed, with our being able to commercialize our almost incredible natural resources, we are exactly in the process of doing as they anticipated, trading natural resources for infrastructure and services. And we are somewhere in that transition. And not in my lifetime, maybe some of yours, we will see a large enough tax base, perhaps, and so on, that we won't be so dependent upon the expenditure of our natural resources. This is an attempt to put some order on what we're doing and to smooth out the spending and investment for the long haul, for the long-term economic stability and wealth of our state. And you might argue that we don't need to discipline ourselves, that this enlightened group who sit around these tables can do it all very wisely and so on. I have a lower view of human nature and do believe that we need these disciplining tools, which is the reason that we have so enthusiastically brought this forward.
And I agree that we need to look at this. I'm not arguing that point. I think, though, that as we do it, we need to make very clear the effect of what could happen from the many different variables that can affect the amount of money that either comes in from natural resources or from other sources, i.e. the federal government, which, you know, if I'm in, you're on the Finance Committee, I know you're looking at these numbers and I'm just hearing them. The increase in the Medicaid budget this year, because of the percentage change that the federal government will fund, and because we use a threshold of 300% of the national poverty level, what does that bring our cost up to the state just in this one year? isn't it somewhere in excess of, what, 50-plus million? I've heard numbers that go up to 90 million. So, you know, that's one of those unexpected things that then if that happens and we have the cap in place, the unavoidable consequence of that would be to say we either shift spending from something else to here or we have to change the threshold qualification limit so that that we have a smaller universe of people that qualify. And I'm not arguing against it or for it. I'm saying it's just a very clear fact to me that as we go forward, we need to make very clear what the effect from these kinds of events could be.
Absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman. And I was with our governor at the Western Governors Conference a couple years ago in Big Sky, Montana, and heard Governor Kempthorne say very clearly in his state, I believe he's Idaho, that 80% of their budget is education and health and human services, and we are approaching the day that both of those will war against each other for a fixed pot of money, and we will be in the position of having to choose between them, rob Peter to pay Paul sorts of things, and very difficult. And both of those tend to be, as it is in our state, kind of formula-driven sorts of things, and your comment about no real control on the front door who comes in is a profound one. I believe those are very significant public policy debates that we need to have, and maybe it's appropriate to do that in the context of this, but you're exactly right that a spending limit will force us to make some tough decisions, hopefully some very imaginative ones about how to control the spending in those two major areas that are a huge part of our budget here.
I was talking with a legislator from Colorado in December who told me that this year in Colorado they'll have the shortest school year in the history of the state because that battle is already taking place with their spending limitation to the point where their state university system is virtually going without state funding and their public school system decrease in funding will actually shorten their school year to the shortest possible in the past. I'm not making a judgment as to the wisdom of that. It's just, it was a fact that she brought to my attention. Senator French?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also somewhat familiar with Colorado. I moved here from there. My dad still lives there. I go back once in a while. And then looking into the spending limit, I did some research about their spending limit, Tabor. And it was enacted in 1992, and there's a group called the Bell Policy Center that does some research into that, and I just want to read a little bit from some research they've done. This Bell Policy Center says that Tabor was enacted in 1992, and they said by 2000, Colorado, had fallen to 50th in K-12 spending per 1,000 of personal income. Even during the 90s, the state fell behind in per capita spending for higher education and public health. By 2000, Colorado spent less than other states on public health care services, was at the bottom on on-time immunization rates, was at the bottom in prenatal care, had the highest rate of uninsured low-income children in the nation, was almost last among states in high school graduation rates, ranked almost last in higher education and the arts, and had a growing list of unfunded highway projects. It goes on to finish with a quote from our Senator Ron Tech. It says, Tabor has complicated Colorado's fiscal life so much that some of its original supporters have soured on it. In hindsight, said Republican Senator Ron Tech, I wouldn't vote for it again. And I guess that's my concern. My concern is that we're locking in a system that just proves inadequate for future needs, for needs 2, 4, 8, 10, 12 years down the road through a constitutional amendment. Last year we talked about doing this either by statute, which would make it easier to change if we got into a problem, or we talked about exempting education. I know we didn't get very far on that possible compromise, but my concern is for education and for public health, just as Senator Sikkens pointed out. And so I'm nervous about this, I guess is what I'm trying to say, and I know you're concerned about it. I know you've thought about it quite a bit, but I wanted to make sure I was on the record as letting you know where my concerns were.
Let me make a comment first, Senator Dyson, if you can hold on to your thought there. But I have taken a look at your proposal compared it to the Colorado system, and you do have some safeguards that they didn't have, that they wish they had. They didn't have the no ratchet down provision in theirs, and they didn't have the ability with the two-thirds vote of the legislature to be able to meet some of the emergency circumstances that I saw. But go ahead, sir.
And I'm going to have, Lucky's been talking to those people a lot, and I'm going to let him comment, but one significant difference between this and Colorado's Tabor is that there they require voter approval for any tax increases, and this does not. This is only a spending cap, and I understand that there is much or more limited by revenue as they are by the cap, but what do you think, Lucky?
If I may, and I appreciate the information from the Bell Policy Center, and I will look into that. I have information from January 2005 issue of state legislatures from the NCSL. They talk about Amendment 23 addressing the schools in Colorado as a separate entity, excluding them essentially from the cap and saying that they have annual spending increases in both primary and secondary education, which is causing a problem because it's reflecting into the cap, but it has it's given those increases regardless of the cap. And so therein lies a problem. The cap is not reducing the spending because Amendment 23 is allowing it to continue. The other thing that they indicated that Colorado has had its troubles, no doubt about that, but they said they're manageable compared to what California faced recently when they continued to spend money to take care of their program, and we know what happened in California. And part of the rationale we have here, part of the language we have here, comes from California, where the Citizens Initiative had put together a program to say, let's get us out of debt, because they have concern. They have essentially, at one point, gotten so far into debt, they're concerned about being able to get out of debt, much like New York was several years ago. How do you get out of debt when your indebtedness, your amount of money you have to pay, is more than you take in revenue? If we end up to the position of having to cover the federal funds, which we will, the question is, how do we do that? Either we go into the, you know, CBR, the permanent fund taxes, somehow we're going to have to come up with it. The other thing we have to do, as you've indicated, Mr. Chair, is we have to look into the future. We can't just take this year and say we have to take care of spending and covering these needs now. I think Governor Murkowski has looked at that by looking for the next couple of years with the windfall, but as our legislative finance folks have indicated, you need to see what that impact will be 2 and 3 and 4 years out, and indeed we should be looking what the impact will be 5 years out. And our planning and our appropriations need to be consistent with what our needs will be, not just this year, but 5 years out. What's the impact going to be? Are federal funds going to continue to trend down? I suspect we all think they will. So we need to be thinking what's going to happen 5 years out, and the decisions we make today have to take that into consideration.
The questions. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Fred, this is absolutely captivating, and I'm the new guy sitting around this table, and I think it's fair to say that I'm probably much like many of the people across the state that when you say spending cap, they sort of like it. And we've seen this in some cases been cited in other states where you know, some cases it worked, some it didn't, but circumnavigation is certainly possible no matter what. I guess the thing that intrigues me the most, though, fundamentally, is how we try to put things into, this case, the Constitution, that safeguards us against ourselves and our own bad habits and our lack of discipline, and the fact that everybody walks by and says, give me some money, and said, if you want a dollar, we'll give you two, and we love you. And we, in the business of discipline, that says, my goodness, you know, I do love you, but remember, it's our money. And, you know, this thing called debt is haunting us. Be that as it may, we still suffer under that dilemma. So my question for you, though, is that Senator Terrio and I were talking about it because I think it's fair to say that, as he says, I've seen lots of these, And, you know, whenever you try to make them functionally sound, there always is smaller, larger mesh in the net sort of thing that allows some seepage factor of fish or money in this case. But as you see this, are there things that make you nervous about it innately or lucky? When because you know the creator of, and this is a improved product and it's getting better over time, but the question is, what are those corners we're painting ourselves into that makes you nervous? Because we are painting ourselves into a corner.
Kind of in order, in terms of self-disciplining ourselves, one of my favorite quotes from Jefferson is, he said, "Speak to me not about the goodness of man, but rather let us bind man's hands with the fetters of constitutional law, lest he quickly run off to do great harm to his fellow creatures." And I think it's altogether appropriate for us in a constitutional republic to bind ourselves and others with the fetters of constitutional law. And we have lots of variables here in our funding, but indeed, it's hard to imagine that the need for more state activity will expand much more than what the population does, and or the cost of business, which is something like what the CPI does. So whatever goes on out there in the future, you know, and all of our critics are quickly point out that we spend more per person in this state than any other jurisdiction in North America. And that's a little bit funny figures, because apples and oranges, we don't have county governments, you know, and we have so much of the area is not organized. The state does a disproportionate amount of business, you know, to take care of people's needs, but we're still far and away off the scale compared to any other jurisdiction and the amount of money that's spent. And if the argument is that you solve people's problems by spending more money, many of the social problems we deal with, just spending more money on it doesn't get at the heart of it. And this, what you have talked about, Mr. Chairman, about the implied principle that if the federal government has been supporting an activity here and they quit doing it, that we have to continue that level of effort is not a presupposition that I agree with. Certainly it's my hope that we can continue to empower people to do more for themselves and rely on government less. And
I agree with that general principle. I just want to make very clear that the pressure will be there for us to do it.
Yes, sir.
And the demand will not decrease because the supply of dollars has decreased.
I think if you noticed this morning's paper that with the new federal budget, President Bush is proposing eliminating something like 160 programs. I was at a conference a few months ago where they talked about looking at the federal government and our duplicated services being performed, and there were something like 40 different agencies within the federal government looking into teenage pregnancy. There's duplication. I think we have a smaller level of duplication here that needs to be looked at. We can do things more efficiently and more effectively than we are now. It's one of the things we need to be looking at. But if I'm fearful of something, as Senator Huggins has suggested, there is logic that says as our citizens are able to take care of themselves more with more income, that they need government less. Unfortunately, what we're finding is that as people are able to afford more, they want the government to provide more also. And so as their income goes up, they want more government, not less. And so my concern is that as Alaska prospers, you're going to be demanded to provide more services and more goods. And I look back to when we first started this whole process of moving forward back in 1970 with oil coming online. There was a study a couple of years ago that said if we had limited ourselves at that time to the national rate of growth and put the rest of the money into the permanent fund today would be $100 billion. And spinning off its traditional historical 5.15%, we'd have $5 billion a year coming off the permanent fund. Now, we needed infrastructure. We needed things at the time, so I'm not saying we should have done that. But the whole aspect is we had the money, we spent it, and we say, great for us, we have $28 billion in a permanent fund today. That's one-fourth of what it could have been if we'd have been a little more disciplined at that point.
I remember voting on the permanent fund years ago, and the reason that I voted for it was it appeared to be that someday the oil field was going to dry up and there had to be a revenue source other than my family checkbook. And it seemed at that time, as a young family man with four kids and a wife and bills, that I certainly wanted to try to protect that family checkbook as much as I could. And it was a wise move at that point in time, I think, to do what we did. And at the same time, I think now, as I watch with some years of experience in government, state, local, federal, I watch the mission creep go on to where it overlaps. It's redundant. Remember a number of years ago trying to get a permit to put a channel off the river by my house. And there were three different agencies just watching after the same fish. And I thought at the time, why can't one do it? Why can't one agency take care of that same fish rather than three? And, you know, it's a full employment program of sorts, I guess. And it has a certain amount of appeal to certain people. But you come to the point of saturation where you can't afford to do much more, and this kind of an approach can help us with that. I do like the fact, though, that when I talk about, as Senator French brought up, the education budget, I remember being engaged in that discussion a year ago, thinking, well, surely, if education was going to collapse because of underfunding, two-thirds of the legislature would recognize that and vote, put the necessary votes out there to take care of educating our children. I mean, what is the risk of that? To me, it was practically zero. In fact, absolutely in my mind, zero. If I was the most fiscally conservative person in the legislature, I probably would vote for it, but we only needed two-thirds vote, if I remember correctly. So exempting one group and not another eliminates a certain amount of competition for funding, and competition for funding, you know, breeds economy itself, making sure that we're not spending, you know, like the proverbial drunken sailor on a weekend, but on leave, on shore leave. But I think we do need to think about those possibilities and probabilities, and the probability that this legislature or any future legislature would shortchange education because they would fail to get a two-thirds vote is beyond my comprehension. Senator, go ahead.
I want to make three somewhat related comments. Senator French's comment that last year we had talked about doing this in statute. Our analysis and what I understand Ledge Legal told us, that a statute spending limit is of little value, because if a sitting legislature exceeds the spending limit, the courts will hold that they did it deliberately and their work supersedes what was done before in statute, and of course it's a principle in our form of government that one legislature can't bind the activities of another one. So if a statute spending limit was challenged in court, it would lose based upon the subsequent action that was taken that exceeded it. And that's what got me less enthusiastic about doing it in statute and the way we thought about it. Also, I understand that states that have a spending cap have almost all of them seen a significant expansion in economic activity. People who are looking to invest in an area who are worried about being subject to deep pocket taxes are significantly comforted by something in place that makes it realize that spending and taxes to them won't go up radically. And we certainly heard testimony in last year's hearings about what a spur it is to investment to have something like a spending cap in place. In all the years that I have been here, the big industries that are investing and want to invest here keep saying they want, quote, financial stability, and they want some assurance that if they invest or continue to, that somebody won't really take advantage of them. And I think this is a significant step in guaranteeing to potential investors that there's the risks of them, the financial environment in which they're operating, changing radically is significantly diminished. And I think that the history of that and the other states' jurisdictions have done this is convincing.
We have before us a amendment brought to us by the sponsor titled A.1. The chair will introduce the amendment. Is there discussion on the amendment?
And just to remind you, if I may, sir, this amendment just takes the stuff out of the bill or the resolution that has to do with the distribution of funds to the CBR.
Is there objection to the amendment?
Extraordinary
circumstances. I'm sorry. I was wrong.
Extraordinary circumstances, yes.
There are a couple of other changes. One, most of the changes are typographical errors or grammar that resulted from miscommunication between me and Ledge Legal. The last page two, lines 9 through 21, introduce a new section similar to what we had last year called Extraordinary Circumstances that allows us to exceed the limit for extraordinary circumstances, however the legislature wants to define that. Obviously, if we're looking at things like a gas pipeline, we're going to have indebtedness, the potential for exceeding the provisions here. We need a mechanism for doing that. This reintroduces what we had last year in SCR 3, a mechanism for exceeding the limit.
Is there objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. We're going to hold the bill over for further discussion, and we'll move on to SJR number 4 right after this concentration break. We're back on the record. Thank you, Senator Dyson, for sticking around to introduce this next Senate Resolution 4, and you have the floor, sir.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. SGR 4 is an amendment to the Budget Reserve Fund, and to date there's always been this tacit understanding that we would use this as a buffer or a shock absorber, the CBR, and that monies withdrawn from it in the lean times would be restored in the fat years. And in fact, we have a pretty poor record of doing that for good and bad reasons. The amendment before you requires that excess revenues, that's revenues that do not get expended in a year, go into repaying the CBR and bringing it up to an arbitrary limit of $5 billion, which, as I said earlier, consultants have told us is a good buffer fund for a state with a revenue picture like ours. It doesn't limit the CBR to being built up to $5 billion. But after the arbitrary $5 billion is exceeded, then excess revenues can be divided in a couple of ways. 50% goes to the permanent fund.
Yes.
25% goes to a dividend, a second dividend back to the people, and the other 25% goes to working off the deferred maintenance list. And I suspect that we've all seen polls that show that the population would probably support a scheme like that. So that's what it does. I think that if we were to do this, it puts us at least in the position of being something like Promise Keepers, who are restoring the money borrowed from the CBR, and gives us a way forward here to have some financial stability. I'm impressed with Senator Wilkins' arguments about the power of those accounts we have and what compounding interest does to them, and I think there are huge steps towards securing our future.
Questions from the members? Senator French?
Just briefly, remind me, Senator Dyson, about how much is left in the CBR right now.
Approximately $2.2 billion, I believe. We have finance ledge back here, or ledge finance folks.
I just needed a ballpark figure, and that comports with my memory. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't off by $1 billion. And what's been our history? Have we ever repaid any of the money we've taken out of the CBR?
I don't know, sir.
I'll bet you Senator Terrio knows. There was a year.
Ask anybody in the audience.
I know there was a year or two where there was small surplus available. Whether in fact it was swept or reappropriated, I believe there was. I'm going to guess that there was one year that we have somebody in the net.
I'm Bruce Tan from Legislative Finance. There have been small surpluses that are swept into the CBR, but then they're usually reversed back out.
Right.
So it's technically about $4 billion into the CBR.
So the debt to the CBR is approximately $4 billion, for the record.
And I guess, I mean, this seems like a good idea to have a state savings account of $5 billion, but if we haven't, during the years that it's been in operation, haven't paid back the money we've been owing up till now, I guess I'm curious about what's going to happen in the future that's going to suddenly change that pattern of not repaying.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio.
We're going to build a gas pipeline. We're going to monetize the resource that we have in the state.
And yesterday I took a look at 32 trillion cubic feet of gas hydrate possibility. You know, there are the So I think, you know, there is that possibility. So with that, I mean, it's not an impossibility. There.
And if I may,
Senator Dyson, go ahead.
I believe we are on the leading edge of a period of unprecedented prosperity in the state, and something I paid a lot of attention to for a long time. And indeed, this is the time, if we're going to institute some discipline for ourselves, because I think the good times are going to roll, and the world needs what we have in abundance. So if we're ever going to do it, this is the time. And you can certainly argue with any of the factors that we've put forward here. How much of the money goes into the CBR? What's the debt service limit? What do we do with the excess revenues, CBR, dividend to the people, working down that? All those are absolutely things we should look at hard and so on. But now is the time, before all this wealth starts coming our way, to decide how we want to discipline ourselves for the future.
Other questions? My intent is to hold these two bills over. We have nothing scheduled on our Wednesday and Thursday meetings other than bills previously heard. So we will continue to concentrate on these two bills for the rest of the week as well. So with that, we're going to hold this bill over and move to Senator Dyson.
Yeah, and I just ask all the members of the committee to let us know the questions and issues you have and get us started on being able to answer your questions and so on, because we are eager to have them all done and this product to be improved and my guess is your deliberations will improve it. So
we've set aside this week of committee meetings to address these two bills and the other two that are in our portfolio. So thank you for being here, Mr. Schultz and Senator Dyson. Next bill we're going to take a look at is Senate Bill 36. Senator Theriault is the sponsor. Senator Theriault, are you presenting?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You can do that from here if you want.
Yeah. Senate Bill 36 has been drafted to address a concern that manifested itself in the 2004 general election. This concern sprang from the decision of the Alaska Democratic Party to have individual absentee ballot requests mailed back to the political party office instead of directed to the Division of Elections. This action resulted in sensitive personal data being made available to political party apparatus without expressed consent. Although there is no clear evidence of any illegal action or wrongdoing, individual Alaskans should not feel that their privacy is under attack just because they wish to participate in a regularly scheduled election. Senate Bill 36 requires that all absentee ballots requests be delivered directly to the Division of Elections for confidential processing. The Act further prohibits a political group, and actually, Mr. Chairman, I have a proposed CS today that would expand that to a political group or political party from assisting or encouraging a violation of the new Act. Would also broaden that so that no individual would be able to, or association or other group would be able to encourage the violation of the Act either. Senate Bill 36 allows for all citizens and groups in Alaska to encourage participation in our election process through the use of absentee ballots. However, once a person decides to request an absentee ballot, they have every right to assume that only nonpartisan personnel of the Division of Elections will handle their requests and sensitive information.
And presently, we're looking at version /G for golf. And Senator Theriault, you have a, is that the CS that you want to introduce, or is the?
I have a blank CS that is a /F version, Brian.
We have Senator Theriault is F. Okay, so we're looking at.
Mr. Chairman, if I could have James Stancliffe come forward, he's my staff that's been
Mr.
working.
Mr. Stancliffe?
Just to make sure that everybody understands the changes in the CS.
We're looking at /F for Foxtrot. Mr. Stancliffe, if you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The CS before you is in response to a question raised as the bill passed out of State Affairs by Senator Elton. And the question was, will this bill and the definition in it prevent a non-political group, and he uses a reference, Trustees to Alaska, which may have caught a lot of ears, or a particular individual from conducting the type of activities that this bill hopes to prevent. Senator Terry asked me to contact legal, and we promised Senator Elton we would do that. We did contact legal, and they agreed that it could be construed as to not protect against a non-political group or person. So therefore, legal has rewritten this to be all-inclusive, that no person or group, be they political or otherwise, should be a third-party intercept in the election process. And that's basically the difference here in the CS before you today.
Isn't the term person all-inclusive in Alaska law?
Yes, it is, from a legal standpoint.
But so that would but it's, so it's for a clarification standpoint that you're saying person or? Senator Theriault?
Mr. Chairman, it was based on that discussion that we had the CS drafted. And so now, basically, you can see on page 1 there, lines 11 through 13, which have the new language added to the statute, basically says, you know, any group should encourage Alaskan voters to participate in the election using an absentee ballot, but it has to be in a form that's approved by the director of the Division of Elections. You can send it out. You can hand deliver it. However you want to distribute it, that's fine. But if the individual voter decides to use that form of election they're required to send it back and send it directly to the Division of Elections.
Not hand it to someone else.
Not hand it to somebody else, not send it to a P.O. box where it's going to be collected up. You send it with your sensitive information directly to the Division of Elections for processing.
Is there, you know, we have before us for consideration /F, do we have a motion to adopt that as a working version, Senator Theriault?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the /F version dated 2305 as the working document before the committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Mr. Stancliffe.
Mr. Chairman, there is one other point that the committee may wish to also consider. On page 2, line 22, the drafter believed that it would be good to specify on the form that is returned by the voter that on the form that the voter receives, that it specifies that it's to be returned directly and not by another person or group.
Who provided
so that
the
there
form?
Is information for the voter to have.
I wouldn't violate this, Mr. Tancliffe, if I asked my wife to mail it for me, would I?
No, you wouldn't.
Because if I was left up to mail it, I might never get there. But it's specifically not to another person providing the form is the intent. Okay. So further discussion.
Well, I'm on that.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd been reading /G, and so I was ready to ask a couple questions about that, but I see we're on a different one. But I guess my question about the form, and I'm on that, I'm on page 2, lines 22 and 23. It says the regulations must require that an absentee ballot application form specify that the form is to be returned by the voter directly to the division and not to another person providing the form. So I think I understand what that means. That means if I'm out canvassing, here's how most of us know how it works. You're out knocking on doors, you know, trying to introduce yourself to the district. You meet someone who's not registered. You have a little form on the back of your clipboard. You say, hey, I can register. You vote right here. You hand that... This is absentee ballots.
Absentee
ballots. Same thing. They say, okay, I'm not going to be here for the election. Do you have an absentee ballot application? You say, yep, I got one of those too. You can register and give an absentee ballot application. You hand them the absentee ballot application. They fill it out. And is there a crime being committed if they hand it back to me and say, would you mail that to the division for me?
Mr. Chairman, if the...
I'm seeing heads nodding, so I'm hoping you're going to say yes too.
If the person is a registrar, if they are legally, once they're... approved by the division to conduct those activities, then they're considered, when you hand it back to that person, you're handing it back to the division. If they're not a registrar, and this is what legal told me, that if you're not a registrar and not an official representative by virtue of that to the division, then the answer would probably be yes.
And you become a registrar, can anyone become a registrar, or is that somehow restricted? It's like being a notary, right? You just go down and...
I believe anybody can become a registrar, but there's instructions on how you're to handle the information, how you're to, you know, make sure that it gets to the division. So there's some rules that come along with that designation that you get for yourself.
But the envelope that they'd have to use would be addressed to the Division of Elections, not as we saw in the last election to... an initial ADN at a certain, it would be very clear that it was going back to the state of Alaska.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, this also, for the record, does not include the Postal Service handling it, who may in fact be the most risky of all.
Just as long as they're unarmed. You know, okay. But there's further questions on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Theriault.
One other section that there was a suggestion, and that is on page 1, lines 4 through 5, where it says, qualified voter may apply by mail or by electronic transmission to the director for an absentee ballot. The drafter just pointed out that, well, somebody can show up in the Division of Elections office and, you know, request in person. And so perhaps we just want to either add in person there or strike out by mail or electronic transmission so that it would be all-inclusive. I have spoken to the Lieutenant Governor's office, who conferred with Division Director, and they felt most comfortable with adding or in person.
So you're proposing an amendment that would say by in-person, by mail, or by electronic transmission to the director for an absentee ballot, maybe after the word apply.
Mr. Chairman, could we have Ms. Kreitzer come forward?
Ms. Kreitzer?
She had the conversation with Ms. Glazer from the Division of Elections this morning about
Welcome, Ms. Kreitzer. If you'd put yourself on the record, we appreciate your input this morning.
I'm Annette Kreitzer. I'm Chief of Staff to Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman. And I did have an opportunity to have a conversation with Laura Glazer, who's the director, who's in another committee testifying, which is why she's not here, and so I'll try to hold the ground. The concern about deleting that language is that there was a really specific reason for putting by mail or by electronic transmission to identify the ways people could apply for an absentee ballot. So our preference would be to add in person to those other two ways of being able to apply.
And will we insert that after the word apply?
Which line are we on?
Line 4 would say a qualified voter may apply in person, comma, by mail, comma, or by electronic transmission to the director for an absentee ballot. Is that your proposed amendment, Senator Theriault?
Mr. Chairman, I would remove that language.
Is there objection to that amendment? Amendment number 1 is adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, I understand that the preference to not have it all inclusive, so you can't apply through a smoke signal, or you can. I mean, it's very clear the methods that are allowable, and I agree with that.
Any other questions? Any other proposed amendments?
I guess I'm still French. I'm still back on the registrar exemption. It must not be in the ballot or the bill that's in front of us. Is there some exemption for registrars?
Ms. Kreitzer, is a registrar considered an official of the Division of Elections?
Sorry for a moment there. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I thought you were saying Ms. Kreitzer is a registrar.
That's what I thought, too.
No, I'm not.
No.
Lieutenant Governor is. Yes, the registrar is considered to be a representative of the division.
So by returning it to the registrar, you would be returning it to the department?
That is division. My understanding, but if Senator French would grant me the leeway to confirm that with the director, because we take your question very seriously and get back to the sponsor, so that if that isn't the case, it can be corrected in a further committee.
If you could do that, Ms. Kreitzer.
Is it your intention to move the bill today, Mr. Chairman?
We can move it tomorrow if we get that clarification. I don't think there's any big hurry, is there, Senator Theriault, to make that correction. However, it's clear on the record that we would intend that to be the case.
If we can just take a day, I guess, to look into that and let me look over this, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Will you be able to answer that for us by tomorrow, Ms. Kreitzer?
Senator Seekins, I could answer it for you in the next 10 minutes if I could.
Well, why don't we just hold this bill for a few minutes, and maybe you can answer that question, and we can move on. So if we'll just set this bill aside for a moment, and we'll go to Senate Bill CS for Senate Bill number 65, our Judiciary Committee substitute, and we're looking at /Foxtrot. And when we last looked at this bill, Senator Theriault had an amendment that was pending. We held the bill with an appending amendment, amendment number 1, I believe, and we have since had some discussion among some of the members. I know there's a letter that I received from the that was addressed to myself and Senator Theriault from the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. The question came up on administrative offices, whether or not we should extend this protection for an aggravator to administrative offices of a school district. As you can see, the Ann Short, the superintendent of schools from Fairbanks School District, Fairbanks North Scarborough School District, has suggested there that we would change the or in, which would be language, the amendment on page would amend page 8 or 9. We do have an open amendment we need to look at, or in the administrative offices of a school district in which students are also educated. In looking at some of the schools, we did a little survey. We found that some of the schools have their school district offices on school property, some have them off school property, some have them located hundreds of miles away from the closest school property of the school district, and therefore the question that came up was, should we, if it's strictly an administrative office and it does not is not a building in which students are also educated, should it have any greater penalty than a borough office or a bank building or any other administrative function? So this is a suggestion that was brought in, Senator Theriault, and we still are considering your amendment, which I believe was to strike the or in the administrative office of the school district. Senator Theriault.
Mr. Chairman, I will remove my original amendment and make a new proposed amendment with this language. And the reason that you've pretty much gone over, it seems like the reason for the additional protection is sort of the nexus, the connector there is students. And when you have a school district that has the administrative office hundreds of miles away in a strip mall or an office building, it just doesn't seem to me that that location, absent that connection with students, deserves to be swept in under the bill. So I think this suggested language is a way of getting to that. Those schools, districts where the administrative office is actually housed in the school building, going to have the connection with the students. I know in the Fairbanks area, we have the administrative office downtown, but they actually run some educational programs out of the administrative offices for those kids that have been expelled from the regular school building setting. So they would be covered because of that, again, connection with the actual students.
And correspondence systems are also there.
So right. It seems to me that this is a common, a sensible way of making division. So I would say to move my new amendment so that on, let's see,
line 8,
H1, line 9, after the word district, we would add in which students are also educated.
Is there objection to the amendment? It's adopted. So further discussion on the bill? Hearing none, the wishes of the committee? Senator Theriault?
The CS for Senate Bill 65 from committee with individual recommendations and the fiscal note on this.
At a zero. There's several of them.
And the at zero fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing none. This bill is passed on to its next committee. We'll recess until Ms. Kreitzer comes back. We're back on the record, and we have an expert that showed up. Ms. Glazer, welcome to the Judiciary Committee. If you'll put yourself on the record, we have a question or two that we'd like to address.
Mr. Chairman, Laura Glazer, Director of the Division of Elections, and I'm here to answer your question.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Glazer, good morning. My question had to do with the handling of the absentee ballot application forms. I think that's kind of what we're after. We're trying to make sure that they go as directly as possible from the person who wants the application to the division without them sitting around somewhere in somebody's office or somewhere else in the meantime. And it looks like this CS that we're on today, this backslash F, is really focusing on the form and the your approval of that form before it gets used by anybody to request an application. So maybe you can describe for me how the form or something else in the bill that I've overlooked declares or makes certain that intermediaries don't collect these ballots and gather the sensitive personal information from the application and use it for their own ends.
Then along with that, is a registrar considered to be an agent of the Division of Elections?
If I may answer the chairman's question first, current law 1507081 discusses registration officials and says the director shall appoint one or more registration officials to serve in each precinct polling places and elections during the hours and polling places are open, and the election officials appointed under this section also serve as a registration official. So a registration official, when you go through registrar training in any of the regional supervisor's office, we also conduct them over the phone for those people who can't get to a regional supervisor's office. They do become appointed by the director and serve as a registration official.
So if I were to give my my application back, I'm giving it to the division by giving it to a registrar.
Senator Seekins, through the chair, that's our interpretation, yes, sir. Okay. But again, I'm not an attorney, but we do accept a registration official who brings that back to Senator French's question through the chair. Ensuring that they return back to us in a timely manner. I don't know how many of you have ever been a registration official while you've campaigned. Certainly, in my previous life, I had been a registrar. And we often find that registrars, not necessarily on purpose and certainly not to gather information, but have kept registration applications in their car or in their or left them on their desk and forgotten to turn them into the division, even though we provide a prepaid envelope to mail those back in to ensure that. And in law, it says you have 5 days to process that, but oftentimes the division gets a registration application that has been signed by a voter way more than 5 days prior to it being turned into the division.
Senator Terrio?
I'm sorry. Not sure whether we've dealt with the
question. We haven't got to final. We're getting into the, is this person considered to be an agent of or representative of the department first? And I think what we're saying is, on the record of this hearing, it's our hope that it is, and it's your interpretation that it is, and so we're accepting that for the intent of this bill would be that that person be considered to having returned this application to the Division of Elections. Is that correct, Senator Terrio?
Yes.
Now,
Mr. Chairman,
if you can help clarify even more.
Sorry, yeah. Again, 1507-100, I interrupted myself, on registration officials discusses that a registration official shall be a qualified state voter and shall take an oath to honestly, faithfully, and promptly perform the duties of the office. The training for the registration officials shall be provided by the director and does occur through the regional offices. On the completion of training, the director may require that officials demonstrate their competence by a test or other method. We don't do that right now. A registration official serves at the pleasure of the director. Each registration official shall be periodically evaluated by the director based on completeness of registration forms, timely filing of the forms, and actively attributed to the registration official. There are tallies made in the record in the database for registration officials. You know how many records they're turning in. We know whether you're an active or inactive registrar. Oftentimes, a candidate files to become a registrar, does that for the time that they're running for office, and then no longer acts as a registrar. And a registration official shall transmit completed voter registration forms to the election supervisor within 5 days following the completion by the voter.
Secretary.
And in part of the standard training, then, would there be some clarification on what you're supposed to do with this sensitive information, that it shall not be photocopied, you know, written down, passed on to anybody else?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, that's correct. And yet there are groups that have made statements to our, in fact, to our regional supervisor in Fairbanks, that they do make copies, even though that they're told not to. They're an active group that keeps copies and keeps tabulation of where their voters are going. There's other than the confidentiality prohibition, we have no way to stop that except for that they've signed an oath. When we find out that you violated it, you're removed as a registrar.
Okay. Senator French, I know we interrupted your question there, and if you can reiterate that for Ms. Glazer.
I guess my question just keeps kind of circling around the same idea, and that is I'm not wanting sort of normal law-abiding folks who are out there just trying to provide an absentee ballot application to the public from getting sideways with the Division of Elections or the statutes of the state. And so I guess I'm back on page 2, lines 22 and 23. And I agree that these forms are best returned directly to the division. It just eliminates a whole multitude of potential problems. And the form is going to say that. It's going to specify that the form is to be returned by the voter directly to the division and not to another person providing the form. But the conversation we just had sort of is a footnote to that, and the footnote is you can return it to a registrar as long as they're
you know, lawfully enrolled as such, then that person can take it home, put it in the mail, and not run afoul of the statutes. And I guess I'm wondering whether the form shouldn't specify that so folks are clear about what's going on, or whether there shouldn't be some, you know, articulation of that idea.
Ms. Glazer, go ahead.
Senator French, through the chair, this is a copy of last year's absentee ballot application form, and so you can see where the voter fills it in, and there's an instruction on the other side. Certainly, we would note the legislature's intent that if you would like that that discussion to be part of the instructions, that you know you can only return this to the Division of Elections through a registrar, or you know the language that you would, you know, we would be happy to work with you. That would be our intent, because it's the same as yours, that we would want, what we want to do is prevent someone from, the term that was used for us was caging the voter, keeping that data and all the private information separate, instead to just move it directly to the Division of Elections. So if you would like that to be part of the instruction, certainly we would probably amend our regulations, that would be part of the regulation process where we could talk about providing instruction that this must be returned directly.
I think that would be good, because I think part of Senator French's concern is for the well-meaning person who may inadvertently violate the law as well. So if that was very clear on the form, I think that would be good. Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please, you know, my concern is not about the innocent person. I mean, my recollection, and when we heard testimony this previously, there appeared to me to be a clear strategy to gather information, which we're now trying to prevent through the mechanism we put in place. My question for you, in the case of registrars, I think you said onesies and twosies per precinct. Is that correct? Registrars that are appointed per precinct?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, no, I should appoint at least one. But there are registration officials throughout the state. Am I answering your question?
Yeah. But
so in each precinct,
in another way, if I, in my community, am an activist and I want to be a registrar with some intent other than just registration, what's to prevent that, other than I'm breaking the law?
Senator,
or do you just assume good intent when somebody raises their hand and say, I'd like to be a registrar?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, the latter. That if you indicate to the Division of Elections that you want to be a registrar, certainly there are candidates from multiple parties who choose to be a registrar during a race. The intent, of course, is to include more constituents in the process, so they would, you know, they have an intention in registering voters. We don't question the intent. We see it as assisting an Alaskan become a voter and participate in the process.
And you have no concerns as far as the registrar link? Because in this case, Senator French is, you know, citing the piece on registrars and their roles and innocence and what have you. And I guess as I look at it, if you're a pundit, you could say that would be a weak link if you were one of these people that wanted to gather information on people, because you're the conduit. You agree or disagree with that?
Certainly, Senator Huggins, I can see your point. But again, if it is brought to the division's attention that a registrar is in fact breaking the law, is in fact using confidential information, that person isn't, you know, we take them off the list as a registrar.
Yep, good. Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Glazer? Is there anyone that wants, Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, Senator French did bring up a question on the Section 4 and Section 5. Where it is the violation of interference with the voting if the person, group or person now, provides a voter with an absentee ballot application form. So it's just that the offense is that you've provided them with a form that doesn't meet, that hasn't been blessed by the division director. Now, the previous CS, language said it is a political group or party that encourages or assists a violation of 1520-81B, which is the first section of the bill. the language that you've added to 152081 talks about an application must be in a form approved by the director and must be submitted directly to the Division of Elections. So it seems, and I wasn't paying enough attention to this language. I'm not quite sure why they have dropped it back now to the violation is just in applying a form that hasn't been approved, and they've left off the part about collecting forms, you know, and caging voters. And perhaps we should consider going back to that language that includes both applying a non-approved form or collecting up.
You have a proposed amendment there, Senator Perio?
Well, I would, and I wanted to see if Ms. Glazer had any comment on that, why.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, I understand what you're raising. I believe the previous version, the State Affairs version, talked about unlawful interference, and that that was what the target was, that by either applying a sticker or by caging the voters, that was unlawful interference. Again, not being an attorney, I see what your concern is, and I think that you're right. It leaves the part that had been part of the State Affairs version that passed out of committee. I don't know that it still deals with those two items. If an application was changed after the voter signed it, or if confidential information was gathered prior to turning it into the division. But so I'm not certain.
Mr. Chairman, so I think if I could maybe move a conceptual amendment.
Yeah.
That we go back to, for sections 4 and 5 of the bill,
mm-hmm.
We go back to the language contained in the /G version, except instead of talking about a political group or political party, we will now just have it broader, so it applies to a person, which would include...
It's an all-inclusive term.
Yes.
Yeah, person under Alaska law is, as I understand it, is an all-inclusive term. It would include political parties, corporations, any entity whatsoever.
I know that Ms. Kreitzer has joined us at the table here. I'm wondering if she has...
As I took her version of the bill.
Ms. Kreitzer, do you have concerns here?
Well, I think that the director can speak to the concerns. I wanted to make sure she had the same concern that I had on the new combining the language.
Go ahead. In the bill before you, in the work draft before you, and I'm sorry, I have a fax copy. I don't know whether that's an F or a P. Subparagraph 5, lines 26 and 27, provides a voter with an absentee ballot application form that does not comply with the requirements. I would like to see that included as well with the change you recommend, not the clear replacement of the previous language, because in State Affairs version, I think I discussed with Dave that, you know, we also want, we want that to be covered as well. We want not only it to be, there to be a penalty involved if you don't turn, if you cage a voter, but also that you don't comply with the regulation that says that where the director sets out that the form shall have these three qualities. So I'd like that penalty, I mean that to be part of this as well.
Mr. Chairman.
For what?
Senator Terrio.
Since we have bills previously heard notice for tomorrow, perhaps we'll work with the drafters on this.
Okay, that sounds good to me.
Sounds very wise.
Is there anything else to come before the committee today? I will tell you that announcements for topics for Wednesday and Thursday are this bill, Senate Bill 36, and SJR 1 and SJR 4. Those will be our topics of conversation for the next 2 days. Anything else to come before the committee? If not, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.